This week on The Breezy Breakfast, we hear from a terrific trio, Haren Hassan, John Stegels, and Karen Rathwell. Each guest shares perspectives on the challenges of climate change and local effects. Water, energy, poverty, and even class conflict are hot topics. We still miss Bev, who's recovering from her recent stay in hospital. Ashley, our diner diva in training, keeps the warm drinks flowing and the rather crusty crowd content. Over to our moderator, Morgan.
Good morning, Breezy Breakfast. Today is Thursday, March the 21st, and we are here at Rise and Shine with our lovely friends and our server, Ashley, helping us out to make sure that we are nourished to start our day. As we gather, let us take time to reflect on our privilege to live in working well, a city built over rich Indigenous histories. We are guests here, and we should reflect upon the responsibility to care for this land, the people who live here today, and the generations to come. If our actions today can move us toward reconciliation, we should take pause and make those decisions with intention and gratitude. This place that we call it well has served as traditional lands and a place of refuge for many peoples over time, but more specifically, Attawandereck and the Haudenosaunee. This land is held as treaty lands and territory with the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation. Guelph lies directly adjacent to the Haldimand Track and is part of a long-established traditional hunting ground for the Six Nations of the Grand River. Many First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people who have come from across Turtle Island call Guelph home today. And as we are talking about climate, environmental, and social justice in Guelph, I'd like to just mention that today, at McMaster University, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy are actually bringing in wampum belts. They are going to be available for people to see, and there are elders that will be there to help understand what the various wampum belts are about. These wampum belts were stolen from the Haudenosaunee and have been repatriated. It is a great honor that McMaster is being allowed to have those wampum belts there for people to see. The reason that they're doing this is protect the tract. And for anyone that doesn't know what protect the tract is, 6 miles each side of the Grand River is the Haldimand Track. That is land that is Haudenosaunee land from the start of the river to where it comes out in Lake Erie. There are something like 38 different municipalities that are building up along those 6 miles each side of the Grand River. And in order for true reconciliation to happen, we must protect the tract. I was reading on Facebook and one of my friends put out a quote from an article that I thought was incredibly important, especially considering what we're speaking about today. The headline was, Indigenous Nations and Worldviews Key to Combating Climate Change Report. Today, we have three wonderful organizations that work in climate, environmental, and social justice at a grassroots level. They're all citizen-led. We have the Guelph Wellington Coalition for Social Justice, represented by Karen Rathwell. We have Guelph Climate Action Network, represented by John Stegels, as well as the Guelph Environmental Justice Collective, represented by Haren Hassan. You may be familiar with some of these groups. Some of them may be brand new to you, and I am going to let each of our representatives let us know what their groups are and how we can join them. We're going to start with the one that's been around the longest, and that is the Guelph Wellington Coalition for Social Justice.
Thanks, Morgan. It is great to be here this morning. I've mostly sat in those breakfast chairs, so it's fun to be up here at the front and talk a little bit about the Guelph Wellington Coalition for Social Justice. And there's a couple of members in our room here this morning. This is a collective of a number of not-for-profit organizations that exist in our community. In fact, there's 20, and they come and go a little bit with regard to how active they can be and how much capacity they can be. But certainly it includes Council of Canadians, Advocacy Guelph, Fair Vote Guelph, Central Students Association, the District Health Coalition, and the Labour Council, Kairos, Ontario Public Interest Research Group, and the Teachers Federation, as well as Retired Teachers of Ontario and Retired Nurses Association, Water Watchers, Yorklands, Unitarian Congregation of Guelph and Chalmers Church, Action, Climate Action Network. John's here to represent them today. No More Noise and Get Involved Guelph. And so with regard to all of these not-for-profit community groups, it's important for us to stay connected so we can align our events so people aren't planning the same events at the same time on the same days, so that we can get our messages out. And as a coalition, we have more power. We rent a table at the farmers market. And so on Saturdays, you can see different members, groups there tabling, talking about what issues are important of the day. And also a number, lots of materials that people can refer to. Often there's petitions for people to sign. But we try to get that message out to our community, because when you're a not-for-profit, it's really hard to get media. And thank you for inviting us here today, Morgan, and Breezy Breakfast. So as a rule, we do a little bit of hands-on, but mostly we're there to support and build capacity for our membership groups. We do Royal City Dinner once a month with Teachers Federations and Labor Council, people also doing that. And we're trying to create this network where people know what's happening in our community. And this year, because of the urgency of the climate problem, Donna Jennison, who's with the Guelph Climate Action Network, and I were saying, what can we do? What can we do ourselves to try and move this along? I figure we've got this next 6 years till 2030 to really make a difference. They're really crucial. And so from just that moment of conversation in the summer.
John Stegall of the Guelph Climate Action Network.
Hi, Eula. I guess I don't need any introduction. I think you all might know me a bit. I'm the loud one from the back, generally. Yes, I'm here to represent Climate Action Network, community, the Guelph Community Action Network. Originated, I guess, it's the genesis of this is from two groups. Back in 2016, there was a group called Guelph Leap, I think it was. It changed to Guelph Green New Deal in 18, and came COVID. And a lot of the groups that were present before have either come through this and are re-emerging, or they just disappeared. We recognized that something had to be done. So, Guelph Community Climate Action Network was born. It consists of four originating members, a gentleman by the name of David Douglas, who's a retired professor from the university, Donna Jennison, as Karen just mentioned, myself, and there was another fourth guy, and I can't remember his James something or other. James. You remember his name? I can't remember. Oh, James Gore. Yeah, you might know. He's part of the team as well. Ostensibly, it came to light. So I'll just give you this brief talk. There is a climate action group within City Hall, but they're mandated to deal with purely city problems in terms of carbon footprint. They are dealing with literally 3% of what the city puts out. So the group has decided to look at the other 97%. There are four stages to this process, but I won't get into the weeds with that in a moment. Maybe we'll get to that when we talk about the taking the questions. Last week, I put out these take the community climate change survey. I hope you all did it. I took one with you, but there are more here today.
We're going to go over to Horeen Hassan with the Guelph Environmental Justice Collective.
Hey, y'all. My name is Horeen. She, her pronouns. So there's a few familiar faces in this room, so some of you definitely know me. but to those that don't, hello. I am with the Gulf Environmental Justice Collective, which is a community-led initiative supported by the Water Watchers. This project seeks to systemically realign Guelph's municipal priorities to address environmental justice issues locally and build an example in Ontario that others can look to for proof of concept, inspiration for community-led change, and replication. The steering committee is composed of key community leaders, which also includes the wonderful Morgan Dandy and James Gordon, who's also in the room with us today. And I do see that Suzanne is in the Zoom room. So hi, Suzanne. And basically, these folks have kind of come together and created an action plan to serve as a starting point from which to confront local manifestations of environmental justice issues through a community organizing approach, and also just a very intersectional approach, because we know that the climate crisis does not exist in a vacuum. It's a very intersectional issue. In many ways, like, climate is a class war, and there are many folks who are greatly impacted by the implications of climate change. And essentially, what we need to do as a community is to build a resilient mutual aid network and support systems so that, you know, as things are getting drastically worse, that we could be there to respond to each other's collective needs and whatnot. And in particular, what this environmental justice project does is it looks at the implications between the climate crisis and its implications on the most marginalized community members. And in this context, it's the underhoused community members here in Guelph that are impacted by the climate crisis the greatest, whether it's extreme weather conditions, access to water, access to sanitation, basically just basic needs are not being met, and the climate crisis is going to make that a lot worse. When it comes to our impact framework, we've got three key priority areas, which is to reduce harm in our community, to educate and engage our community members, and to work towards building long-term change. So when it comes to that first goal of reducing harm in our community, some of the goals stemming from that include ensuring that there are interim equitable access to sanitary services, short-term solutions for sustainable free drinking water access, and access to shelter space during extreme weather conditions, whether that's heat or cold, or even, you know, last summer there was a lot of smoke due to the wildfires. So, you know, just making sure that people have a space to go to. I know that we got to work towards long-term solutions, but then we also need to, like, address the harm right away. And there is a lot that needs to be done now, because we can't wait 5-10 years for more substantial solutions. Meanwhile, people are struggling right now. So that's why immediate harm reduction is a big priority for us, while also at the same time advocating for long-term strategies to mitigate and end the negative implications of the climate crisis on the vulnerable population. And with that, we're looking towards universal and sustainable access to drinking water, sanitary services, and housing in Guelph that is dignified and long-term. Also, at environmental justice and human rights approaches being embedded into our local policy and planning initiatives and whatnot. And then also looking to run a public awareness campaign and engagement campaign on environmental justice issues, and really educating people on how, like, the climate crisis literally intersects with so many other issues and why we need to pay attention. So this group is a lot newer, and we've been moving slow but intentionally, and now we're kind of getting into the doing and some of the things we've been doing. Like, I'm sure you all have heard about that public space use policy that Cam Guthrie was trying to implement, or the problematic encampment bylaw that was being proposed. So a lot of our work is also trying to change municipal decisions and making sure that the approaches are just.
Thank you so much, Maureen. And I am looking forward to hearing a little bit more about the various actions and events that are upcoming. I know that there are a couple of great ones that are climate focused. So Karen and John, why don't you fill us in on why now? Why is everything that you're doing right now so important? And let us know how we can get involved.
Yeah, thanks, Morgan. And Joan and I will do a little bit of a tag team thing here. We'll talk firstly. I just want to say how what the genesis of our actions is. And I want to say that I do a lot of reading, and I probably could be doing more, but recently my readings have been a lot about climate change. And last summer, I was reading a book. I'm not here to plug this book, but it certainly is a great read. And this is called Petroleum Papers. Since that, it's 2022, I think. So it's reasonably new, but not. So there's good, accurate information. And I was so disheartened reading this book. It really affected me, understanding the history of the fossil fuel industry and seeing and having worked as a volunteer with Water Watchers and personally experiencing the playbook that's used by big corporations in order to influence us, fake groups that are formed, lots of money pouring in, misinformation started on purpose to kind of confuse us, because when we're in a state of confusion, people don't know what to decide and we're easily influenced. And this book, Petroleum Papers, really spoke to me because I started to see everything unfold that I had already seen unfold in my volunteer work with Water Watchers over the previous decade. And another thing that kind of got me thinking was in 2013, so 10, 11 years ago, my daughter was doing her PhD at Waterloo, and she was invited to speak at a YMCA girls' march break camp for 10 to 13-year-old girls. And so we chatted about it, and I'm a retired educator, and I said, Caitlin, you know, one thing you really do need to be careful about, you're speaking to these young people, don't scare them. Like, climate change, it can be really frightening. And I certainly felt that fright with Petroleum Papers. And she stood still. She stared at me. And she said, Mom, all of us should be frightened. And I'd never heard her speak like that before. She is such a positive person. She'd never spoken to me about what she was learning and where she was going with her work in environmental climate change for a PhD. And that's something that's really stuck with me. All of us should be worried about. And so I think between reading that book and having that memory brought back, when Donna and I first started talking, I felt such great relief, because I don't like to talk about this stuff too much. I do to my kids, but not to my neighbors, my friends, my family. It's not the sunniest topic to talk about. And people don't like their days to be brought down, and yet we've got to face it. Our city's asking us to reduce our GHG emissions, this 97% that John's talking about, our community, by 63% by 2030. 63%. Think about your own lives. How could you pull back more than half of your GHG emissions of what you're doing right now? Whoa, that's a huge leap. It's about 7-8% per year if we just can do that every year till 2030. So that was huge. And that's why John and I said, we've got to do something. And at the moment, at that time, I was the chair for the social justice group, and Donna was getting this group, climate group, started. And we said, we can do more. But we also needed input from our community. And so we thought the best way to start was to host a survey, which will be at the farmers market for the next two Saturdays. We want input from everybody. If you don't think climate change is a problem, we want to know that. We want to know what you're thinking, what you're feeling, where you get your news, what you're doing about it personally, just all of the things that we can collect information. And this work that we're collecting will inform our work next year, because Ron, at Social Justice, we're not done yet. So we're going to keep on this for the next little while. It is so important, this next little window to our decade. And that is the reason why we've got a survey. We've got cards here today. John will be referring to them as well. And on one side is our climate survey website link. And on the other side, a number of events that we're going to host. We can speak a little bit more about that to try and engage the community. That's the plan. John, do you want to add to that?
Why is it important now? I guess a bit of history, a long-winded answer here. In Earth's evolution of about 13 billion years or whatever it is, there's been about, they claim, 5 or 6 mass extinctions due to heat and cold cycles. The difference being, of course, is that those cycles in a natural sort of way take thousands of years each to happen. If you look at the data from the 1800s and the Industrial Revolution, you'll see that that graph spikes and is almost exponential in the way that we've treated the Earth in terms of what we're pumping onto it and into it, through it, whatever you want to call it. That's why it's important now. We can't afford to wait. We really can't afford to wait any longer.
And you're not waiting, John. So what's the first thing that is organized other than the questionnaire, the survey that is available online as well? What's the first action that your group is putting together?
Not just our group, a coalition of a few groups here. But the first thing that's going to happen is a film screening panel discussion in the bookshelf. And it revolves around a movie that a gentleman's made called 2040. You can see this movie if you can find, if you can get on the CBC Prime. Prime. You can see it before this event. There will be a panel discussion at that time, I think, with Evan Ferraro and Tuva, lady from Waterloo, Davidson, lady from Waterloo, who's part of their inspirational and very successful environmental program that they've got going there. The second thing is an Earth Day event, we're calling it, which is on April the 20th, 12 to 1 o'clock outside Guelph City Hall. Please join us to celebrate, and I quote, mourn, sing, and make noise, and commit to doing your part to protect the Earth in 2024. Fourth item is a community climate forum called Every Degree Matters, Every Action Counts, which is Saturday, May 4th, 1 to 4 at the Italian Canadian Club. I guess you all know where that is, 135 Ferguson Street. That's going to take part. That's going to be consisting of 3 parts. There'll be a discussion on Guelph's record on climate action to date with guest speakers. And part 2 is to participate in the breakout groups and get into what people's opinions are, what a red and what a green line activities, which are most urgent, which can hold back. And part 3, a network with the multiple community groups, and they will get together with local vendors that we hope to attract around it. So if you see your way to heat pumps, you see your way to better windows, those people will be available to talk to, and you can go and talk to them immediately about what you might be able to do with your own personal situation.
Thank you so much for that, John. And Maureen, I just wanted to ask you, I know that Guelph Environmental Justice Collective has been asked to join on May 4th. What other actions has environmental justice done to this point?
So I did speak of our first one around like engaging in municipal politics and whatnot. And so usually we like to use NUMO tools, petitions and whatnot to really target our municipality to take action. We are also working with the city of Guelph to work towards having a short-term solution, but then also long-term solutions for water access in the Guelph community. And what we did is we started with local businesses with little signs in their windows to indicate that they're a water access point. And then we'd like to expand that to sanitation so that anyone looking to use the bathroom could kind of know where they can go. Just by, if you're walking around downtown, you see a little sign in the window that says water and sanitation access. Like, you know, you can ask for water and use the bathroom there. We are also looking at, we hosted a community connect event, not too long ago, where we, met up at Royal City Mission with our Guelph community neighbors and, chatted a little bit about like what issues were most prominent and forefront for them. And then did some brainstorming around solutions that folks would like us to implement. And so this next phase of our work, where we're basically taking a look at some of the things that were mentioned and actually turning them into actionables. So at the moment, like, I can't really plug anything that, unfortunately, I can't really be like, look out for this, and come on out. So I can't plug any events right now, but I do want to say stay tuned, because there will be actions coming down the pipeline and there will be ways for engagement, and all of your voices are important, and your
okay, that's awesome. Now that we know a little bit about the organizations and the actions and events that have happened and are upcoming, we're going to turn it over to questions from the audience. Phil, you've got one that's come in.
The first question that I really want to ask is for Maureen, and then I have a couple of requests for Karen as well. Maureen, you made a very provocative statement with which I do agree, and that is that you said that climate change is a class issue. I was just wondering if you could expand on that and explain why climate change is a class issue.
It is very simple. As I said before, it is the most vulnerable in our community that are impacted by the climate crisis the greatest, and in like the most visible and apparent community members that are impacted are underhoused community members who are living in encampments or living rough. They're going to be impacted the greatest by the climate crisis. And then there's also anyone living in, anyone who is precariously housed, and just like low income neighborhoods too. It's like where they're located, what kind of resources they have access to. I've been saying that like we're one natural disaster away from being in a really bad situation, where many could be unhoused. And so it's obviously the wealthy, the upper middle class folks who will be able to kind of lean on their resources and their privilege to aid them when climate crises intensify and whatnot. Meanwhile, a lot of the poorer communities, middle, lower class communities, like they don't have access to the same resources and privileges as those that are wealthier.
And you made that very, very local, and I think that's really important. What about globally? Do we recognize climate change as a class issue globally? Does it affect people around the world differently?
Well, yes, of course. We've been seeing natural disasters and crises happening a lot in the global south, and it is the global north or the Western countries that are most responsible for the negative implications of the climate crisis. Meanwhile, you see countries like Nigeria, Pakistan, basically paying the price for the emissions and the environmental destruction of the West. So it's very apparent to see that too.
Thank you very much. And the next questions are from Karen. A couple of questions here. Karen, another controversial word, and that is fear. I'm wondering if you could please address that, because I think that I tend to agree with you. My wife and I were talking just the other day about fear, and we're in a situation where we have a young grandchild and another on the way. And she said, for the first time ever, she's starting to fear for the kids growing up. And it's not just fear of the environment. It's fear of environmental actors, Putin, Trump, so on and so forth. What do you mean? And how do we keep people thinking positive about how we can change things?
Well, that's a loaded question, Phil. I'll say right off the top, come to the bookshelf event and view 2040 and listen to that panel discussion, because that does inspire. There are so many things happening around the world right now, but we don't see a lot of that. You have to dig for that kind of news. Here in Canada, we are a resource-based country. Let's face it, we always have been. And so those that have been doing this fossil fuel industry for decades have the power right now, and they want to stay there. And so they're not just going to give this up freely. They need to keep us locked into fossil fuels in order to keep that balance for themselves. So the fear is, this is a dying industry. It's evident. We have to let go of fossil fuels. We have to keep them in the ground if we're going to get anywhere with regard to these emission targets. And so fear, there's fear in a lot of sides, but mostly we're afraid of change, trying something different. Everything that I've done has only, just personally, has only made my life easier. Eating more plant-based diet, a little bit less expensive and better for me. Driving around less saves me lots of time, and I coordinate all my chores. And soon to be giving that up and doing more walking and doing more things that are in those environmental minds. But mostly I just want to talk about grandchildren. I'm a grandmother. I have one little granddaughter. She's 6 now. And most of my neighbors and my friends have grandchildren. And I know that each one of them would walk in front of a moving bus to save their grandchildren. I know that. And yet here we are with this huge global problem on our hands in a wealthy country where we can make choices and we can do things. What are we afraid of? Are we afraid of divestment? Well, that's hard. When I had to tell my financial advisor, who I trust, I said, I don't want to have any more fossil fuels in my portfolio. Get rid of them. Oh, well, are you sure? Well, there's not much out there, but we don't usually do this. And there was a lot of kickback. Well, funny, I got what I wanted. And what about just divestment of your everyday money? What are the banks that are fueling the tar sands? Find out if your bank is one of them. I learned that at one of Florine's events and saw my own bank's logo sitting on a card on the table. And that was enough for me to say, okay, I don't want my money used for fossil fuel to lock us into that. So all of these kinds of things. And then the fear is taken away a little bit. Every time you make an action, you feel a little bit better. You're part of the solution. Sometimes it's just finding out how we're involved, and we don't even realize.
Thank you. And as I go to Juanita, a comment. It's very interesting. One of the things that also I think we need to consider is public policy. I just heard today before I came here that Canada is celebrating the Trans-Canada Pipeline, which is old technology at a time when we're talking about how do we improve the future. Juanita.
Thank you, everyone. There are so many thoughts going through my head. And one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit is what Haren was saying about class being involved. And I'm thinking particularly about the working class, where I have a brother and his wife in a rural area where they both have decent enough jobs, but they certainly don't have money to buy a brand new, better, whatever car. They're buying beaters because that's what they can afford. My brother particularly has to drive to work all the time. The car has to be fixed all the time. And like Haren said, one mini disaster in a family that should be doing really well could be really, really harmful. I'm also thinking about, I love that they're working to make sure everybody has access to water and sanitation. Washroom facilities are so important. If you can't have a house, it's basic and it's long overdue. And I'm really excited to hear about that. I'm also thinking about fear And this is my personal opinion, but I think, you know, there are lots of reasons to defund the police. I'm thinking defunding the military could be so much, have so much of an effect on what we're doing to the planet. And what is continuing to happen in Gaza is devastating for so many reasons. One, if this continues, where does it end? And the other is, what is going to be left there when it's, I'm not even going to finish that sentence.
Thank you. Does anybody on the panel want to respond to that? Hurry.
I just want to say thank you for that. The one comment is, it is so expensive to be poor. And you're not only paying like the price financially, but you're paying it with your body. It's hard on your body. You're paying that price in so many different ways. And the environment is also one too. So that is just something to keep in mind. Because not everyone can afford the thing that will last them a while too. And one thing that like you do sometimes see in the climate world, which is a little toxic, is like the shaming of poor people, which is, you know, it's like individual responsibility, yes, but what do we really need? We do need to dismantle these systems of oppression that are basically upholding white supremacy, capitalism, colonialism, imperialism. And that is what is what's basically making us all suffer in so many different ways. And to your point, Juanita, all of our liberation is tied to one another. So we need to really look at that in a way where we can dismantle all of these oppressive powers and institutions that exist to actually maintain this status quo.
Thank you, Marie. Before I go to a couple of people in the restaurant, I have one question online from Sheila, and it's a good one. It's a serious one. And she says, nuclear power is rearing its very ugly head as a way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. House gases, we see that here in Ontario with the idea of mini reactors. Mining minerals to make batteries for our battery-powered vehicles is full of environmental human rights abuse. The question is this. Are we replacing harmful methods of fueling our greed with other harmful, albeit less serious, approaches?
Yeah, the nuclear issue does bother everybody. It's green in its inception, but what do you do with the stuff afterwards that was stuck for thousands of years with that we keep in ponds that could be leaking into our water system or anything else that's going on? It's a very difficult solution, a difficult problem. But of course, the way to avoid that is to go to more sustainable methods of creating power through the use of air, water, and the energy stored in the ground or even in the air. Heat pumps will take that energy and will convert it to heat for your house. The battery situation, and I've been looking at the EV situation in quite some depth over the last little while. In fact, I've written something that will be coming out on our newsletter coming out next month. There is rapid development of batteries to the point where they are now experimenting with 8 different chemical combinations, which don't involve cobalt or lithium or any of these things, things that are a lot less harmful to us in terms of physically us and what we're doing to the earth. So Tesla and the ilk are really, really pushing hard on this. So I think this is a problem that's going to be overcome, along with a lot of the issues that people talk about with EVs. It's only a matter of time that these things are going to be sorted.
I think that we need to actually split the two issues. I think the issue of nuclear energy and the issue of storage batteries are two different things. And I come back to the issue of harm reduction. I've been working with a number of people on addressing harm reduction and addiction. And it's the same thing. in many respects. We are addicted to our energy usage. And the question becomes, how do we reduce the harm at the same time as recognizing that there is an essential need in some respects for these things? So if we look at it from a context of harm reduction, we look at storage batteries, batteries for cars and so on. Is it better than petroleum? Or do we need, as Karen said, maybe just get out and walk a bit more? And maybe that's what we're dealing with. There are many improvements that are coming along, and I look forward to them. And I hope that my electric car and James Gordon's electric car are part of the solution and hopefully not part of the problem.
I've been a bit concerned. We work hard, and I agree with what everybody is trying to do in terms of both the environment and climate change. And I think the two get sometimes confused. Climate change is a global issue, and it doesn't respect any borders. And it's getting worse, not better. And unless we start to do something on a global basis, we won't turn it around. I feel that sometimes there's a lot of pressure being put on individuals and on consumers to try to spearhead this sort of change. I think I agree with Juanita that, the prospect of, I drive a gas vehicle, I admit it, but I'd love to get an electric vehicle, but the cost of a new electric vehicle, because you're not going to get a secondhand one, a brand new one is what, $40,000 to $60,000? I mean, and there is no indication by the government that there's going to be any help in people being able to do that, to accomplish that kind of change. A huge percentage of the population just won't be able to afford it. So, how do we actually, as individuals, respond to it? The other aspect of it is the environment. And so I think that, we talk about reuse and recycling. I feel that a lot of times in recycling, different corporations say that their materials or their packaging materials, et cetera, are able to be recycled. But in fact, they're so expensive to recycle that, in fact, people can't actually do it. So what my suggestion is that we should lobby governments to institute a corporate waste tax.
Amen.
To make it prohibitive to continue to create a huge amount of waste and, focus all on the individual and the consumer to actually take up the slack.
Passing the mic over to Mike.
One of the hardest things to do right now is to get the standard media to talk about positive actions that are actually going on that deal with climate change, public water, better public health. I mean, the list goes on and on in terms of what is public wealth and versus private. In the United States, like we are in Canada, they're struggling with the carbon tax. And my memory isn't working this morning, but it's either the state of Washington or the state of Oregon, which has become sort of the bellwether of how to put in a carbon tax and get benefits from it in a way that the citizens support it very strongly. And although it's attracted all the interests of the private sector who don't want it, there's enough public evidence, there's enough action going on that it becomes harder and harder for people to knock it down. And so rather than having Trudeau doing whatever Trudeau does and Polyev doing whatever Polyev does, you actually have an informed experimentation going on as to how to deal with it. So I guess too bad Andy wasn't here to find out how do we get more positive news on the good results that are being achieved and maybe reduce the fear factor that people feel that the problems cannot be solved, which is the last thing we want.
Karen?
Well, I have spoken to the fear factor already today, but I'll just remind people the best way to get rid of those angst, that feeling. I remember opening the door middle of February, my front door in the middle of February, and I smelt that beautiful smell of spring. I could smell it. And there was a piece of me that was like, woohoo, it's spring here. And then I thought, hey, it's February 18th. this isn't a good sign. And then inside of me, I had that smashing feeling where, and that's the fear you're talking about. I want to be happy. But in contrast, I was just thinking, this is not right to have this in Guelph, and let alone our snowfall. We need snow melt. I know that from and Marine from our work at Water Watchers. We are a groundwater city. We may not feel like we're going to be affected by floods or rain or swollen rivers, or we may not feel these are any of our problems, but we need to make sure our water is replenished every winter, and snow melt is the best way to do that. It eases, it oozes through that aquifer nice and slowly. Rainwater doesn't do that. It often just gets swooshed off the top and then down into the sewers and into the creeks and rivers. So the fear, yeah, how do you address that? No, nobody wants to talk about fear. And one of the things John didn't get a chance to mention was at the forum on May the 4th in the afternoon, a Saturday, we're launching our carbon conversations element to our plan. And this is an opportunity for people to sit down and speak with a small group, maybe 10 people, with a professional facilitator that can talk about these fears that echo anxiety. And particularly, this is what our youth are feeling. And this is one of the reasons that I stepped up to this and will continue. We need to validate the concerns that our young people are having, not just life is normal and we're going to go ahead as we always have done. We need to prove to them that we know it's serious and we're doing something about that. We can't have our high school kids going around feeling that I don't care feeling. And I've been an educator, and whenever a child has said those things to me, I know I have to step up as the grown up in the situation to help make a difference with that I don't care feeling, because that can only go south when kids start feeling. Do you want to add to fear?
Actually, Maureen, I was going to ask you something very directly. And that's something, when you talk about snow melt, this is a concern of mine. Maureen, does the city need right now to start paying attention to our fresh water, drinking water reserves? And what do you suggest?
I think, obviously, that is definitely something we need to think about. And I do know that the city is also gentrifying as well, and the population's growing. So it's definitely something that we do need to pay attention to.
Before we get too far, just to answer a couple of Ron's things there. When the EV revolution started about in 2020, when it was really at its height, the car companies, I don't think you can call it a mandate, but they were instructed that their prices would have to come down. Tesla has done this, I'm told. I don't see it in the numbers. Apparently, they've reduced their price by 20% as time has gone on. Don't know that for a fact. The other major companies haven't. They've totally ignored it. They've continued to put up the prices of their EVs, which is totally wrong, contrary to what we need. But that's the way I understand that situation at this point.
I have Glenn here who has another question.
Not so much a question, more a comment. They're almost daily, Polyev and premiers and whatever, about X attacks, get rid of the carbon tax. It's just too expensive for us, you know, it's too costly for people. I would like to suggest that people stop and think about it and ask themselves, well, how much is it going to cost me to rebuild my house if I live in an area that is prone to forest fires or flooding? Who has heard the term atmospheric river 10, 20 years ago? First, I think I've ever heard of an atmospheric river is about maybe 2 years ago. Up until that time, what was it? Did it even exist? Suddenly we're getting these downpours where you're getting a foot of water in a 24-hour period that's destroying properties all over the place. So, you know, how much is it going to cost me when the insurance companies jack up my insurance rate, even though I don't live in an area that is prone to flooding, prone to forest fires, whatever. How much is it going to cost me to rebuild my house when there's no lumber left because the forests have been burned down? In terms of rainfall, and John mentioned about renewable electricity sources, hydroelectric. Have you considered the fact that if we're not getting rainfall, we're not replenishing the water in our streams, which then is resulting in lower water flows in the rivers and lower electricity reduction? Okay, how much is that going to cost us? Electricity rates, go up because there's not enough water in the system to generate the electricity. How much is it going to cost us to buy our food when places like the prairies can't grow the grain because there's not enough moisture? These are things we should be thinking about, as far as I'm concerned, anyways.
Karen?
Well, sure. I remember Maud Barlow years ago talking about the soft root in the hard root. I can't remember, she has more professional terms about how we approach problems. And that right now we still have this little window where we can go the soft route, where we pull back on what we do, rather than building infrastructure. Running out of water in California, well, we've all heard that. That's decades old, that kind of in and out of route there. What have they done? They've built a desalination plant. Imagine building that. And what does salt do to infrastructure? And what are they doing with all this extra salt that they're taking out of the water? And that's something I worry about as a water activist, because they're shipping it up here to the northern parts of North America to be used on our roads. And we don't want that either. There's all kinds of ramifications, just like you've outlined here. And we can go the soft way right now, pulling back, or we can wait and then start building dikes and desalination plants and all kinds of other infrastructure that maybe we could avoid.
I remember the other thing. It was on the news last week. Either Norway or Sweden was powered, the whole country was powered by renewable energy, which is, they're miles ahead of us. That's stunning. That really is stunning. They're only tiny. There's only 54 of them. But, the thing is, if they can do it, we can do it in little pots. Little areas, we can do it.
And thanks for that, actually, John. Before I get to Aaron Caton and then a couple of other questions, your point about renewable energy is very important. Costa Rica is completely powered by renewables, and it's not impossible in various jurisdictions. At one point, and even still today, I think we need to appreciate that Alberta has more renewable energy than anywhere in Canada, and yet it is the most regressive of all administrations when it comes to renewable energy and non-fossil fuels. So it's not something that we cannot do. It's definitely possible. There is a political will and a personal will that can make these things happen. Karen, you had a comment?
I do, because, Phil, you've made me remember something. It's so important. And that is, we can do something in Guelph starting this month. And that is, we can step up to ask our councillors, city councillors, to support Leanne Caron's motion to support the Ontario Energy Board decision about not putting new gas lines into new communities. That is a huge signal to our youth that gas lines stop here. We don't need to do that. Why lock new homeowners into an archaic system when they don't need to be? And I know the spin on this is that these new homes are going to cost so much more, $4,400 more, because if the developers have to put the gas lines in. Well, you know what? They don't. They don't have to put those gas lines in. What they need to do is put in electric furnaces and heat pumps and raise the standard of their insulation, not go to the lowest bar on the insulation rate, but build these houses to a higher standard. With just a heat pump and better insulation, those homes will be coveted and people will be moving Guelph to move into these beautiful new homes that are way more energy efficient for the rest of their homeownership life. Whereas our gas bills are going to go up and up and up. And people like me, I'm getting rid of my gas dryer. I've already got rid of my gas water heater. I do drive electric. I have my solar panels that will power my own electric car. So I don't even have to worry about those rates going up. But I'm still in the system and I'm in with everyone else because we can only do, we can all do what we can and not everybody can do those things. But it's really taught me a lot about energy and how much even I waste. And so, you know, the more you think about these things and that we can get down to a city hall on March 26th at 10 o'clock and put our butts in those seats and show support, that our city can take that first step. And I know in the community energy initiative and the district plan, this is years ago, this is a decade ago, there were plans to put thermal heating into buildings downtown through pipelines, through wastewater, through our sewage. And this is happening in six municipalities as we speak. They are doing, they are heating communities through their wastewater. And so, wow, is that ever brilliant? Why aren't we doing that when we're doing, last week we heard about infrastructure in downtown Guelph in the next year. Isn't this the perfect opportunity to make something brilliant happen?
Thanks, Karen, for all those provocative statements. Just a couple of comments before I get to Councillor Aaron Kate. Certainly there, I believe that we will be passing that motion. The critical mass for that had already been established. The one thing that I want to stress is that we are just one community and we need more communities. And more importantly, we need more people to confront the Ontario Energy Board and make certain that that the OEB stands by that particular recommendation. It's very important. So next Wednesday is extremely important. If you can, get out, delegate early, delegate often. The only way this is going to happen is with popular support.
Our councillors need us to speak up. If we don't say anything, they don't think it's a problem. And so we need to say, yeah, climate change matters to me.
But sorry, Aaron, now you might want to comment on this one as well. One of the real challenges we need to hear from people is that the mayor has determined through strong mayor powers to limit our budget to a 4% increase next year. If we don't have the money, we can't do what the public wishes. Aaron, you've got a couple of questions. Let's hear from you.
I'm also very much in support of Councillor Caron's motion. Okay. So I think that it's great and folks do need to go out and delegate to make sure that all the other councillors kind of feel that too. I'm a multiply disabled person. And so I have a lot of around the intersections between disability justice and climate justice. And sometimes they fight each other. So like we have a lot of issues with cars and bikes versus accessibility and people who need them for their personal transport. The straw ban was an issue for folks who have medical needs for plastic straws specifically because the individually wrapped ones are safer for their immune system and for various other things. And then there's issues with veganism versus different food allergies. For me, one of the main things that concerns me is simplicity, because that is one of the ones that is a benefit to both. So scented laundries have a number of chemicals that, especially with laundry systems, they get into the air. And California did a study on how much of an impact that has. And it contained about 3% of the same emissions that cars do for various chemicals. And recently, New York State banned 1,4-dioxane from all laundry products. And that is in almost all scented laundry products. So in terms of personal accessibility and personal climate movements, I was just wondering if that is something that your group had considered and lobbying the provincial government, because I've tried on a city level to think about a scented laundry ban. And the staff told me that pushing the provincial government is the way to go to get that actually enacted in a way that would be legislatively enforceable.
Well, like so many things, that has to come from our city council is the only way that you're going to get any leverage. And it goes along with so much of what we're trying to achieve here. The various schools of thought about how you achieve our aims you know, people say, well, it should come from a groundswell of support from the public or various factions within the community. But also there are people that say that's a waste of time. You should just go straight to your city council and demand action. Well, I think we're trying to do both with the various groups that are going on, and that would surely be part of it.
I just wanted to add, I've never heard of that. And so I'm very delighted to hear about that laundry scent. And I notice that when I'm walking in the neighborhood, when people have dryer sheets and so on. In fact, I've learned maybe just in the last 2 decades, walking down that laundry aisle in a store, I can't even do that anymore. I have to run and hold my nose because there's something, I don't know what it is, but whatever is in the air in that aisle makes it start to itch and it's uncomfortable. So I can see that maybe there's somebody listening today that would like to take up that sword, because hopefully today will be about our community stepping up and taking more action.
Go ahead, Mike.
And just, I just want to do a quick follow-up when I mentioned about the fear thing before, and I was mentioning either the state of Washington or Oregon. What they did with their carbon tax revenue was invest significantly in their public transit system. So you could see dollars here at the gas pump, public transit system, and then they gave free bus passes to anyone under the age of 13, those who are still in grade school. And so every day, the kids know that by taking a bus, they're part of a climate change solution, and they're now looking for other ways. So they're not like, you know, I know there's a boogeyman under the bed, but I don't want to look to make sure it's there. They actually have something that they can do about this problem. Another thing we should be doing, we got involved in a bit of this on talking about EVs. Heat pumps are one of the major ways to go. But anyone who's taken a look at it knows that the better one you get in terms of the ambient temperature outside, the more expensive it is. We've got 15 really good engineering research schools in the province, and we've got to get the province and maybe even the feds to start investing in what does a better heat look like, and can we start producing them? That's a lot more important than EV batteries.
Thank you for that, Mike. And probably Love would have benefited a lot had we not abandoned district energy and centralized heating.
I guess this is kind of a follow-up. I'm thinking about how individual changes can only go so far, and we need to push corporations and industries to change. But the comments that Karen made about fear also brought some hope, I think. And the idea, I don't have a big investment portfolio, but for those who do, even, you know, a decent size, if they push to get out of the harmful corporations and industries, that puts a whole lot more money available for research and development into actual helpful things. And I'm going to be thinking about that.
And with that, I think that I'm going to sum it all up and thank our guests for having been here. Maureen, who had to leave for another appointment, Karen and John, who have spoken very, very passionately about their concerns for climate awareness and climate activism. We can take the mantra of Ralph Nader and the public interest groups to heart. Think globally, but act locally. Whether it's a heat pump or whether it's the amount of waste that might be produced, whether it's driving less, walking more, let's consider what we can do to ensure that our children, our grandchildren, and 7 generations to come can benefit from our actions. Now, on a good news note, maybe, so we don't have to belabor this, we don't have many announcements today because Tanya is not with us. But one that I'd like to point out is that next week we will be talking about an initiative coming from the community, not from the city, on tiny homes. And this is being put together by a group of very erstwhile people within the community who have been developing support for the principle of helping people to get in out of the cold. I think it's going to be very worthwhile. We don't know who's going to show up right now. It could be a woman by the name of Liz Hales, or it could just be me. But I do want to point out this is a community initiative. And for anyone who's concerned about downtown or about homeless encampments, safety, risk, and so on and so forth, this will be a very broad and multifaceted discussion. Thanks, everyone, for attending Breezy Breakfast today and for those listening online.
That's all. Thanks. Music provided by Jules Germ, and the podcast was produced by the CFRU Media Center. Breezy Breakfast. The conversation is as hot as the coffee, and the issues as filling as mom's flapjacks.